Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 270 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the first of a two-part interview, Charles Jennings speaks with Catherine O'Flynn about the lost era of career magazine journalism and how his early career consisted of being roped in to everything from writing books and plays to TV work, and the pros and cons of writing to spec.
Charles Jennings is an award-winning writer and journalist. He started writing full-time in his mid-20s, appearing in the Sunday Times, Daily Telegraph, Observer, for which he was a TV critic, Financial Times, Daily Mail, Independent, as well as The Spectator, Vanity Fair, GQ and Esquire. He's been a columnist for The Guardian and Times. He's the author of 13 books, including his Wise Guy travelogue, Up North, and the critically acclaimed social history, Them and Us, a study of the American invasion of Edwardian high society, and a Radio 4 book of the week. In between, he has written drama for Radio 4 and the Orange Tree Theatre in Richmond, presented the property show for Thames Television, been a visiting fellow at Goldsmiths College, and co-founded a wine blog whose greatest moments were recently memorialised in book form, Sediment, which went on to win the John Avery Award. He's married with two sons and lives in London. I met Charles at his London home to talk about his long and varied career, being a hamster in a wheel, and to question his deprecating assessment of himself as simply a lazy journalist at heart. I suppose my first question would be, I'm always interested in how writers ended up being writers. So did you grow up in a house with a lot of books? Were you a big reader as a child?
There were quite a few. It wasn't really a bookish house, but yeah, there were books around. I mean, it's really embarrassing to admit, because good writers are almost invariably good readers. They read a lot, and I'm a bad reader, and I've always been a bad reader. And I mean, I churn through books enormously slowly, and I've done that ever since, right. You know, could read. So I don't quite know why I got the idea that I wanted to write.
Right.
Although, you know, who doesn't enjoy reading getting lost in a book or whatever? But at the same time, when I was 10 or 12 or something like that, you know, I used to read thrillers, you know, Alistair MacLean.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Agatha Christie's, I suppose, crime novels. And so that sometime around 10 or 11, I started writing, you know, my idea of prose fiction, you know, which would sort of last a morning and then that would be the end of that. So I must have had this idea that that's what I wanted to do, and it just sort of persisted. And then I thought, well, you know, basically I just want to be left alone to kind of follow my own inclinations or not work very hard or not have to get on a, you know, all those kind of reasons for not doing everything else, so it only leaves you with writing. So I said, It just stuck, and I never really questioned it terribly hard. I thought, oh, I really must get a proper job, you know. I after university, I spent a year training to be a lawyer, and I thought, this is not
okay.
This is a bad idea. I'd have been a disgrace to the profession. So that just left me with, and then I just sort of gradually accumulated work, and that was it in my mid-20s.
Okay. And so, because I read the piece you wrote about Martin Amis's essays, which I see there, and was great. It made me want to go back and reread them. But I was just wondering, had there been anyone like that in your youth that you'd sort of read and thought, oh, yeah, I want to do that, or not? It sounds like not so much, perhaps.
Well, I mean, once I got through the kind of Alistair MacLean, James Lisa thriller writing phase, you know, and then I sort of turned 15, discovered girls, poetry, music, like you do. And I actually, after that point, I think I was going to be a playwright. And I did write some plays in the end. I was just mad for Tom Stoppard.
Okay.
Because, of course, this was the first half of the 70s.
Yeah.
When he was absolutely, you know, he was just huge. And it was, he was sort of, you know, he was, when one of his plays came out, the Jumpers Travesties period, you know, and he'd done Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Dead and all that, and he'd done all sorts of short plays, all of which I went to see at the Shaw Theatre in the Euston Road. And I just thought he was wonderful, and I still think he's great, actually. He's really terrific.
Yeah.
And so I then spent about between 5 and 10 years writing plays that were kind of a bad pastiche of Stoppard, which then became a bad pastiche of Joe Orton.
Right.
because I sort of fell in love with him. So actually I thought, oh yeah, I'm going to be a playwright, but probably just as well that eventually that craze sort of fizzled out. So, but yeah, in the early 70s it was, yeah, Stoppard then blending into all the kind of stuff, you know, kind of very highly stylized, mannered sort of playwriting. Mm. And for whatever reason, I just thought that was great.
Okay. And so you say, like, you did a year training as a lawyer,
mm.
and then you, as you say, sort of drifted into writing. Did you start off in journalism, or I wasn't quite sure how it began for you?
Yeah. I mean, I was sort of sitting there with a pile of unproduced play scripts, you know, under the bed. And then Susie, now my wife, who has a much more practical and confident mind, said, you do realise that you could do journalism and get paid quite well for not very much work. You had thought of that, hadn't you? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, now you put it that way, that is... So I started writing for... I can remember it very clearly. I just sold an idea to Cosmopolitan magazine, you know, because mm-hmm. this was... Now, jump forward, now in the early 80s, and, you know, Cosmopolitan was flogging this idea of the new man and all this sort of stuff. But that's me to a T, I can do that. So I started off writing for Cosmopolitan and She magazine. I don't know if it's still going. And Homes and Gardens, these sort of glossy monthly magazines.
Yeah.
Because it was just easy to place work and they paid quite well. And then I started writing for newspapers. But yeah, it was after, you know, those days, after about a year or a year and a half, you know, you place one piece, they get you to do another one that allows you to sell yourself to some other new publication. It just sort of built up really quite sort of straightforwardly, quite easily. And at the same time, as it happened, I still had a play knocking around, which then got produced at Richmond, some sort of synergy, you know, one of those sort of, you know, when everything sort of happens, you know, wait, three buses arrive at once sort of thing. So sometime in my mid-20s, I thought, oh, yeah, OK, I seem to be making a living out of writing in various sorts, and it just sort of went from there.
Yeah, yeah. That, I mean, I suppose those were the days that could happen. I'm curious, I guess...
It seems like a lost Kingdom of Atlantis,
practically. Yeah, like how would a young Charles Jennings happen now?
I don't know, because we got two sons, and they're both pretty grown up, and they're both in sort of media and creative... With varying degrees, I'm certain, you know, you've just got to teach or have some, which I mean, I was also doing. I mean, I was, you know, just like everybody, you don't really have a clue. You've got a useless university degree in English. So I was tutoring, you know, I was teaching A levels and O levels and anything that sort of came up just to make ends meet. So they teach at various levels and so on while they pursue, you know, the things they want to do, which are, you know, filmmaking and acting and writing and all these kind of things that don't pay anymore. But you go back 30 years, it sounds, I feel so old, and I am. There was a lot of advertising money around that kept a lot of institutions and publications and outlets just very viable. Yeah. Publishers as well were much better healed. You could just see when I started writing books, which again, I didn't really have an idea for it, but I'm just at heart, I'm a lazy journalist. That's all I am. If nothing happens, I can't be bothered to make it.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll scratch away for a morning and I'll take the afternoon off. But publishers approached you with ideas. They said, all right, you can clearly write a bit. You know, can you do it at length? Yeah, all right, what's the pay like?
Right.
Really was like an agent and so on would approach you. Because there was just so much cash sloshing around.
Yeah.
And it only really sort of ground to halt about 10 years ago, the 2008 crash, and a lot of publishers who'd been hanging on absolutely by their fingertips suddenly found that there wasn't any money anymore and they had to amalgamate or disappear. You know, so there was a very distinct change to 10 years ago. But pretty much up to that point, there was... And, of course, newsprint magazines and so on, the rise and rise and rise and rise of the internet.
Yeah.
That sort of... That turned off an awful lot, as we all know. I mean, that turned off an awful lot of their currency.
Yeah.
So, but up to that point, advertising was really keeping everybody rich as rich.
Yeah, it is remarkable how quickly it's changed. You know, how you think, how is that possible once to be a kind of a magazine? I remember when I first
Yeah.
You know,
what about, yeah.
Well, that was briefly what I thought. You know, I wanted to write for The Enemy or The Face something.
Yeah.
And now, you know, that's just a laughable idea that that would be some kind of a career.
Yeah, and people going off to journalism school and getting traineeships with provincial papers like you're supposed to do to learn about crime reporting and holes in the road and all that sort of stuff. And, I mean, we know that there are endless outlets there. They're all over the place. We consume them all the time. If it's on the internet, I'll have it. Thank you very much. So there's clearly, you know, there's tons of things to do, but I don't know how you monetize it.
Yes.
Some people do, but, you know, I'm too old school, really.
That's the question that I most often ask myself. How do I monetize this?
Monetize. I like the sound of that word.
Yes.
Tells a good story.
Yeah, you read to me, and you think, that's actually quite good. How could I... nobody wants that. That's not going to turn into money.
I know. So, yeah, I mean, in Precy, like everything, it sort of seems, oh, well, that was a golden age. Actually, at the time, all I ever thought was, yeah, but wait a minute, he's getting, or she's getting, more than me for about the same sort of, how do I get to where they are? Because that looks better. And this is all right, but that looks better. And then maybe you get there, and you think, you know, there's always somebody else. He's getting twice as much, and so on. And that, so you're always sort of consumed with, you know, envy for people who are doing even better than you.
Yeah. So moving on to books then. Yes. So you're saying that kind of editors... In the early days, they kind of just commissioned you, is that right? They sort of come to you with an idea.
Once I picked up an agent, my first agent, she was great, I really liked her. And she just, what was the first thing? Oh, yeah, she just approached me and said, look, do you want to do a book about... We just had the big bang followed by the great crash of 87, I suppose it was. 86, 87, I think it was like it took about a year. Do you want to do a book about, so clearly something about which I knew nothing... I'd just been reading a lot of Tom Wolfe, very 80s figure, you know, Purple Decades and all that sort of mau-mauing, the flat catchers. And I thought, okay, I'll do a Tom Wolfe kind of a thing. And they were kind of, you know, this is, I can't remember who it was now, Hamish Hamilton or something like that. And they were kind enough not to throw it back in my face and produce it. So that was that one. And then I think something about being in your 30s. And you know, they just... And I have no recollection, but my agent just rang up and said, do you want a, you know, light-hearted sort of thing? I thought, fair enough. You know, and so John Murray. And we sat in John Murray's legendary office off Piccadilly with letters from Byron and I don't know what else, you know, and Jane Austen's quill pen. There's all these artefacts dotted around the weight of history. And I do this little throwaway book. But that's something that, it just sort of rolled on. And then I got him, and then I did a few books for... Little Brown, who are now part of Hachette, I think I'm right in saying.
Yeah, I think so.
And my editor there, he just sort of, I do one book and then he'd feed me. Right, and I come up with an idea and say, look, this time, why don't we do one of my ideas? Okay, what's your idea? And I tell him what the idea was. He'd go, that's a great idea. Here's my idea, which what we're actually going to do. And he'd do it over lunch. You remember lunch, you know, the liquid lunch, the literary liquid lunch? Of course, by this time I was plied with food and drink and had no resistance. Oh, I could probably manage that. And one occasion he actually said, got to keep the hamster in the wheel, got to keep the wheel spinning. Let that run out. So...
you were the hamster, I'm assuming
I'm
that.
I'm clearly the hamster and he is the wheel. Well, he's not even the wheel,
no.
he's the room in which the wheel sits. So, in fact, kind of, these days I feel slightly ashamed because of all the things that I've... It sounds like, you know, it's Frank Sinatra or something, but all the stuff I've churned out... The actual amount that is entirely generated by me is relatively small as a percentage. I can't think it's got a word count.
Yeah.
Really, you know, a lot of books have either I've had an idea with somebody or somebody just come along and said, do you fancy doing this book? Or do you fancy writing this piece for the newspaper? I think I just remember the plays had to be completely original. Nobody came to me and asked me... But then again, now I think about it, when I did a play for the Orange Street just down the road, it was great theatre, and what was he called? Sam Walters, terrific guy. Anyway, I did this play, and I think I ended one or two acting careers, because it was one of the stars had been in a big TV sitcom with Molly Sugden, and he said, I'm getting back to my roots, I'm going to do live theatre, never heard of again. actually done my play. But then
it wasn't Molly Sugden that finished him off then.
I wish we'd had Molly Sugden. She'd have brought a few more bums on the seat. And the Arts Council sponsored me as well. Can you believe that? Anyway, God, dear, really does.
That was worth the
day. The year is 1893. The Empire is riding high. And then he did say, well, do you want to do another one? By that time, I was doing something else for telly, which was, again, I'd just been roped in.
Yeah.
And of course, the telly money was so lucrative. I wish I hadn't now, but I just thought, I just can't be bothered to try and think of another play for the delightful Sam Walters at the Wonderful Orange Tree, because I'm just, these checks keep flopping through the door for this rubbish I'm doing for ITV. So, you know, just laziness took over again. And I thought, maybe I'll buy a car this afternoon. No, I'll do it tomorrow. You know, I really, but honestly, it was like, it just sounds insane, but.
No, well, I mean, I'm wondering whether the...
I feel terrible just thinking about it now.
I wouldn't feel terrible, I'd feel great.
Should have tried harder.
No, I don't. But I was going to suggest to try and make you feel better about yourself.
I need it.
Maybe to some extent that sort of having other people sort of give you these... But that was very constructive to you, having those kind of constraints to work against, you know. Maybe that kind of brought out some of your best work.
Ooh, very good. I like the way you're thinking. nice spin. I don't know. I mean, because, you know, you never go... I don't know about you, but, I mean, I just don't go back and reread my stuff unless I'm just looking something up. Because it's either better than you remember it, which gives you think, wow, I've lost it, or it's much worse.
Yeah.
And you think, what was I doing? But... It's entirely possible that somebody says, look, you've got 1,200 words for a newspaper or magazine, or you've got to do a book about something, and it's got to be about this length, and it mustn't involve that, it can only involve... I think that is good, actually, because left to my own devices, which I have been on occasion, I do tend to sort of, you know, that over... Because I've only ever written non-fiction.
Yes.
I mean, I've tried, apart from a few plays, and I've certainly tried writing fiction, but... It's so hard. And when I do non-fiction, if it's just down to me, I will just put too much stuff in.
Yes.
And, you know, and then you get that sort of, you know, enough to fill the Albert Hall, this pile of fascinating junk with no clear narrative and no particular reason for, you know, including. So, I think probably I do better if somebody, unless it's something which happened, you know, something for which I have no sort of sympathy or feeling or understanding, and then I'm not terribly good at it, you know, I'm just not. But as long as I can find a spark of interest, I think you're right. I think it does. Yeah. The constraints are good, really.
Yeah, I think. I mean, speaking personally, I think I would benefit from that massively.
What do you do? What's your stuff?
I write novels, right. But I'm insanely unproductive, and that's because, you know, I don't. I'll spend years, you know, coming up with an idea, and I think someone throwing ideas at me and saying, "Why don't you do this? Yeah. Why don't you do that?" would be really good for me. I mean, I'd hate it on the one hand because I'd think, but it would actually be good because you just, you know. Stare out the window and waste weeks.
Well, then you sort of think about genre writing, because then that comes, you know, because everybody's now writes sort of police procedurals or thrillers or crime thrillers or something like that, because it, you know, that just gives you a kind of a world to work in automatically. I haven't even tried, and also because everybody's doing it, you think, well, I'm so the last person to arrive at this party that I really should do something different anyway. But
yeah, no, I think like I'm sort of slightly. Turning away from fiction and feeling the lure of non-fiction much more. Maybe, as you say, it's easier, or maybe it's just that it's a bit more tangible and a bit less ridiculous than making things up all the time.
I mean, one of the best sort of, you know, because there were a couple of books that I did sort of 10 and a bit years ago. I did two in succession. That's about it, really. And I don't know why, and I just had these two ideas that I just was fixated on, which probably, that's in itself is really a bad idea. And one was about these... guys between the wars who are speed kings.
Yeah.
I have no idea why I was so obsessed with this, but I was just, because I was doing a book about Scotland of all things, kind of comedy book, and I just saw this little part where John Cobb, the legend, you know, who's he now, but at the time he's a big, big star, where he died, because they always get these jet boats on some flat piece of water and it explodes. Why? Yeah. You know, you think they learn. And for some reason that just set something off, and that and the one afterwards, which has nothing to do with that, was all about dollar princesses marrying impoverished British aristocrats. And I don't know why, where, but again, I was fixated on that. And actually the best bits were obviously not the writing, but they were just hanging around in libraries and archives. And you come upon something that you think, oh, nobody else had spotted this. Or even reading letters, you know, from some sort of American aristocratic bride thousands of miles from her original home, you know, set to every sad letters from Duchess of Manchester. And that was just wonderful. It was so exciting. I just love that process. That was better than any kind of writing, really. You just come back at the end of the day. A, you'd done a bit of what felt like real work. You had to go out and do something. And then, you know, and you come upon something that you weren't, you know, you hadn't seen anywhere else, and it was thrilling sometimes. That was great.
Yeah, I can completely see that. And, you know, I'm always after something that, well, it's paradoxical, isn't it? You want something that feels like real work, but I obviously don't want real work. that would be crazy.
Please, no.
I'd like the feeling of
no cold callers, no real work. Yeah.
That was Charles Jennings in conversation with Catherine O'Flynn. You can find out more about Charles on the RLF website. We'll feature the second part of this interview in forthcoming episode 274. And that concludes episode 270, which was recorded by Catherine O'Flynn and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 271, Rupa Faruqi considers the struggle of diverse new writers, and Trish Cook explores her sense of responsibility to diverse audiences and characters. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.